From the far northwest corner of our nation, where Washington State meets the water, where Puget Sound is their Ohio River and whales are their catfish, comes the adventures of a ferry boat busker. I'm Alexander Watson, author of River Queens, and my guest is Alan Levy, author of Blue Water, Blue Grass, The Ferry Boat Musicians. I want to thank you for coming, Al.
I'm happy to be here.
Blue Water, Blue Grass is a memoir, isn't it?
Yes.
But rather than a trip down memory lane punctuated with quaint anecdotes of limited interest, it betrays you as a man with a mission to recover for us the experience of music you believe we lost when Edison first recorded sound. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
It was a discovery I made early on as a ferry boat musician that there was something special going on here. And it came to me that even back in the late 70s, people were getting most of their music from a box instead of from live, direct, personal contact with a musician, and that we'd become disconnected, and that the ferry boat music gave people a chance to be not just up close and personal to the music, but a chance to be part of the music.
Do you think that the formality of a music hall setting also affects that?
It does, of course. The context and environment defines people's behaviors, attitudes. It sets limits on what they feel comfortable doing and not doing. And as ferry boat musicians, we essentially made everybody welcome. We were already in the same boat, so we might as well enjoy the ride.
But it wasn't really quite enough for you to perform and provide music. You and your partner at the time really went out of your way to engage people in a physical way.
Yes, we never went any farther than the people around us wanted us to go. So we'd always start off sitting, the two of us in a booth playing music for each other before the boat started. And then we would pick up the energy of our music as people gathered around. Then as the boat was leaving the dock, we would launch into one of our very much high energy tunes. And as the boat sounded the departure whistle, announcing it's on its way to Bainbridge Island, we would finish the song with a flourish, and it would naturally bring out applause from the people around us. And then we'd step out of our booth, stand up and say, "That's what we call a standing ovation. You ovate and we will stand up and play for you." So we'd already established that, hey, we're already doing this because you want us to. It wasn't something we were doing to them. It was already established. This is something we're all doing together.
When we think of ferries here, we think of flat deck swing ferries like those that cross the Ohio at Aurora, Kentucky, or the Anderson Ferry. So can you kind of set the stage? What is a super or jumbo class ferry? And how are they perfect for engaging the audience?
The super class and the jumbo ferries in the Washington fleet are big enough to hold up to 200 cars on two separate car decks where you drive directly on. And typically a run between destinations would be anywhere from 30 minutes to as much as an hour and 40 minutes. So on the deck above the car decks is a passenger lounge inside with very comfortable seating, a cafeteria, large windows. It's a very comfortable, inviting place. And above that is an open deck with seating that and some coverage in case it rains. And we would always sit at the front end of the boat. These boats are symmetrical. They're almost identical front and back. So when they get to one end, instead of turning the boat around, the crew would leave the bridge on what had been the front that will now become the back, and they move to the bridge at the other end and get ready to go back the way they came. So after every run, we would always pick up our instruments and set ourselves up at what would be the new front of the boat, because the front was always a little quieter. The back end of the boat with the propellers turning and the engines roaring was a little harder to play music in. So these are symmetrical boats. Not completely symmetrical, but symmetrical enough to where one end almost looks like the other.
And you had the boat noise to deal with. There are instances in the book where you found that something that you would incorporate into your act. You want to tell us about that?
And anything that happened around us became food for our act. So when on one of our very first runs, when we were getting close to port and we weren't sure, people got up and started to leave like 20 minutes before we docked. And so I made a joke. Was it something we said? Why is everybody leaving? And then people said, oh, no, we're just getting ready to go. What happened, though, as we got more established on the boats, is people tended to linger longer around us, and it sort of slowed down the congestion of people heading down the companionways and getting back into their cars, that in a way, without meaning to, or that wasn't part of our plan, we made the ride not only more enjoyable for the passengers, but we in some ways made the work easier for the crew.
You have a captive audience because there are these people in passage on a boat. And that's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you've got an audience that can't go anywhere. And on the other hand, you have an audience that can't go anywhere. So how do you manage that? And how does that benefit the crew on the boat?
We only did as much as people invited us to do with our standing ovation. People would gather around, and so there would be less mess around the boat. The times we played were generally not commuter runs, but family time, where people would be going for an afternoon outing across the bay to somewhere else. So there's lots of children. So instead of children running wild on the boat, we've got them all as our captive audience right in front of us. And we engage the kids in our music and we engage people so that it was a little bit less chaotic with kids running loose, and the atmosphere on the boat was happier because people were having a good time. So the crew had less stress from the passengers, less complaints to deal with. It was basically a win all around.
You explained you owed a great deal of your success to your partner, and you almost always performed in duet, except when there was a passenger who wanted to join. And there was one in particular named Brenda who had a habit of bringing on board with her a pair of wooden spoons with the anticipation that you might be there and she might get to play.
Between runs, we would often take a break. Steve would go out on the deck and smoke, and I would go indulge my addiction to 70s era video games. And so I came back to our booth at the front of the boat after having gotten my asteroids fixed, and I saw this man standing in our booth looking curiously at our instruments. And he reached down and picked up my fiddle, and I'm particularly sensitive about people handling my fiddle. So something about him said that he knew what he was doing and that the fiddle just seemed to look very comfortable in his hands. So I introduced myself, and he was very confused. And he's like, "What are you guys doing here?" And I explained to him that we're the ferry boat musicians and we ride back and forth on weekends and play music for folks. And he said, "Do you work for the ferry system?" I said, "Oh, no, we're completely unauthorized. We just do this." And I explained I even gave a banjo lesson to the captain. And so they looked the other way. And I asked him if he played music. And he said, "Well, I play classical, not like what you do." And he handed me the fiddle. He said, "Play something for me." So I played an Irish jig and I handed it back to him. I said, "Well, you play something." And he was kind of shy, and I had to push him a little bit. And he did, though. He did the most amazing thing. It was as if he turned my little fiddle into a whole orchestra. This man stood up, and suddenly you just saw this transformation in his posture and his expression. And even it was almost as if he transformed my fiddle. And from the first note, he filled the whole passenger lounge with the most amazing sound, like some Eastern European fast-moving gypsy rhapsody. And he was just all over the neck and the strings, and people just gathered around. And it was this very energizing moment. And then he comes to this beautiful crashing crescendo finish, and everybody claps, and we're just all in awe. And he hands me the fiddle back, and I'm speechless. And I'm not a guy who's usually at a loss for words, but the only thing I could think of to say in that moment was, "Gee, you're pretty good." So he smiles and walks off, and I don't think any more about it until the following Sunday. I'm sitting there warming up, and a woman comes up to me with this interesting look on her face, and she says, "Remember last week that man who played your violin?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "Do you know who that was?" I said, "No." She said, "That was Henry Siegel. He's the concertmaster of the Seattle Symphony, possibly one of the finest violinists in the nation. I thought it was cute when you told him he's pretty good."
You have had a career as a clinical psychologist.
I've had a lot of jobs over the years. My current career is clinical psychologist since I got my master's back in 2001.
But you're still doing gigs, and you have a current partner you're working with.
Yes, my son, Adam.
Tell us about recruiting him when he's 2 years old.
Adam grew up listening to music, listening to his parents play music, and about the time he was born, I'd released an album of children's music that Adam came to call the Papa Tape. And by the time he was two, he wasn't quite speaking in full sentences, but he was singing the rhyming words at the end of every line of every song on the Papa Tape. And his grandmother, my mom, had given him a toy plastic guitar that he carried around with him everywhere. One summer, I had a gig at a festival in the Park Strip in downtown Anchorage, and I was getting set up to do my kids' music gig, which I normally did solo. And as I'm getting set up, I look to my side, and there's Adam, 2 years old, clutching his little guitar, standing next to me, looking up at me like, "Yeah, Pop, I'm ready to do this." And so I had the sound man put a microphone in front of him, and I knew what was going to happen next. So I launched into the first song, "Oh, the Fox Went Out on a Chilly," and I stopped, and Adam filled in the rhyming word right on cue, right on time, right in rhythm. We went through the whole song that way, where I did the line, he did the rhyming word, and it was a showstopper. Hundreds of people had gathered around to see this, and there's this phenomenon. If a few people are watching, and then we got done with the song, and everybody just clapped amazingly, and Adam rushed off stage back into his mom's arms, and that was as much as he could do that day. That was the start of a career.
I'm Alexander Watson, author of River Queens, and my guest has been Al Levy, author of Blue Water Bluegrass, The Ferryboat Musicians. Al, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Alexander. It was a pleasure. I hope we get a chance to talk again sometime soon.
3 months ago, on a cold, clear night, I caught a mouse. He put up quite a fight.
Leads with a right, and then with a left, and another right, and
he ran up my sleeve, and then he ran down my pants. I turn on the stereo, he started to dance. He did the Watusi on the living room rug. I laughed and I clapped, and he gave me a hug. Now he lives with me in his own mouse cage. He plays at night and he sleeps all day. Nobody knows, nobody sees my long black mouse and me. He runs in his wheel and I watch it spin. Sometimes race, but he always wins.
The winner and still champion is the long black mouse.
He's starting to sing and he's learning to speak. We both love cheese and I'm starting to squeak. Now he lives with me in his own mouse cage. He plays at night and he sleeps at night.